All right, shall we get started? Okay, so today's going to be a discussion on the bootstrap and holography, or the other way around. And Alex is going to start, and then Sandra Penn will follow us.
Great. Thanks a lot. Let me start by thanking the organizers for setting up this really nice program and for giving me the opportunity to speak. Let me also take the advantage to say that I guess, more or less as of today, I'm the new social coordinator.
Oh, yes.
Which gives me the power to make you do stuff. So, yeah, please come see me and organize as many social events as you want. And there, I haven't sent the email yet, but there will be a barbecue tonight at the residence. So please, I'll come.
And cocktails.
Okay. And cocktails, thank you. We were going to get into yes, okay. Well, great. There's cocktails confirmed now tonight. Perfect. Good. So the plan of the discussion session today is to talk about the bootstrap and its relevance in holography and quantum gravity. And so the plan we came up with Sandipan is that I'll start by giving sort of an overview or my vision of an overview of where we are right now. And then Sandipan will dive in a bit deeper. So one question that we would very much like to know the answer to is what is the space of UV complete, of consistent UV complete theories of quantum gravity. Or maybe a slightly different way to ask that question is to ask, well, which QFTs can be consistently coupled to gravity? Good. And, well, I won't have essentially anything to say about flat space or perhaps the sitter space in this context, but I guess there'll be a whole program about this starting, I don't know, in a week or 2 weeks or something like that. But what I would say is that if you talk about ADS, we could say that at least formally ADS-CFT has solved that problem, or has answered these questions. The result is, well, it's the space of CFTs. Good. And so the strongest form of the ADS-CFT correspondence says that, you know, all CFTs are dual to some theory of quantum gravity in ADS. And what we mean by that is the following, is that the observables of a conformal field theory, at least at the local level, are the set of correlation functions. And for any correlation function, I can always interpret this as some type of scattering process in ADS. Yes.
Wouldn't you want to require that the bulk is at least sort of more than stringy size to have any meaning to that statement?
Okay. So yes. Good. So of course I'm going to be more precise than just this, but at least at a formal level you can think about this if you want. It's a little bit like specifying the S matrix. There's not really an S matrix in ADS, but there's conformal correlators, and this gives you a full non-perturbative definition of quantum gravity is. Now, of course, as you just mentioned, if you pick a generic CFT, like maybe your favorite CFT is the Ising model, and then you're going to ask me, well, you know, okay, that derives that defines for you a set of scattering amplitudes, but does it have anything to do with gravity? And the point is that, of course, it won't, so...
Well, every CFT looks like gravity at very, very, very long distances. Very super ADS scales in some sense. I think everything is a theory of gravity. It just might only have locality on exceedingly long distance scales. So for a generic CFT has like free correlators at large spin, for example, where you have things that...
Yeah, there's some kinematic... I mean, there's in some sense, there's some regimes that are fixed by kinematics. where you can, you know, you can then the usual gravitational picture that we like from ADS CFT will apply there. But those are, you know, those are regimes that are fixed by kinematics in some sense. And well, I'll get to that. The whole interesting part is to go beyond that. Okay, but the point is that if you take a generic CFT and then maybe you say a generic kinematic regime for the correlator, it'll look very different from, you know, semi-classical GR.
Another issue is that perhaps we have a requirement which is too stringent in the sense that this will give you some UV complete theories of gravity that are expanded and also are in a vacuum which is stable. So you could imagine that you have an ADS theory with in an unstable vacuum, metastable vacuum, that is fairly long-lived and so on. So that theory naively should make sense at short distances, and probably yes, it will decay to something else. But it might be a consistent theory of quantum gravity, not completely stable. But
right, so it would look like this for a long period of time, and then it would transition into something else?
It would be UV complete in the sense of what you are discussing here, I think, in the box. There in the box, it's not clear whether you are demanding that it is completely stable, that the vacuum is complete. For the standard model, we think we can UV complete it to gravity, perhaps.
Let's hope.
Some other things like dark matter, whatever. But maybe only in a metastable vacuum.
That's true, I guess, yeah.
And this method, it's not clear with this method how we're going to.
How we would account for something like that. Yeah, so I agree, and I think this is somewhat of a restriction in some sense, but maybe, yeah, I mean.
Well, anyway, it's what we can do.
Yeah, it's what we can, exactly. We do what we can, let's say. So I guess maybe I should add the word stable somewhere here and say, you know, that this. Yes, question.
That's really a question about number two.
Well, maybe it depends on what you mean by consistent. But I think the usual way that these questions on the left are defined, you don't require it to be vacuum, which is absolutely stable.
Right. Okay, thanks. Yeah, so to some extent, this does place some restrictions. But the way I like to think about this problem is that it sort of inverted the way we maybe typically think about these questions. I mean, typically here, what we'll do is we'll start in the IR. We say we like GR as a low energy effective action. And you have to worry about, well, how the hell am I going to UV complete it? In ADS CFT, we sort of, instead of, so the usual picture is a bit of an IR to UV question. And in ADS CFT, in some sense, we flip the problem around. The UV is good to go. It's built in. The CFT is a UV complete object. And the only question that you need to ask about is, well, what happens in the IR? And the whole point, as Veronica was asking, is that we don't just want anything. In the IR, what we would want is a theory of semi-classical, you know, weakly curved, weakly curved. And of course, the point of what I'll be discussing for the next couple of minutes will be to make these things precise, but GR. And, you know, perhaps plus a finite number of matter fields. So what this does is that it enables a slightly different perspective where you just consider, well, the full set of CFTs, and you ask a little bit, well, what are conditions? And you can look either for necessary or sufficient conditions that will guarantee you that you have, you know, semi-classical GR and IR. Okay? And so in some sense, that has flipped the question around. So what do these conditions look like? So I'll start a list. Number one is that gravity is semi-classical. And this will not surprise anybody. This can also be called the large N condition. Let me box them along the way. Hopefully you can have them all on the board at some point. So how would you diagnose the strength of the gravitational interactions? Well, what you would do is you would compute a three-point scattering process of gravitons. And so in the CFT, the way you compute such a thing is you look at the three-point function of the stress tensor and say if you don't want to worry about normalization, you could just divide it by the two-point function, so the 3/2. Okay, and this process is given by, it has a coupling constant here, which is basically given by the Planck scale over the ADS scale, maybe for some power that depends on the dimension. And this dimensionless number here, we're going to call 1 over n. And we'll demand that n is much greater than 1. Okay, if n is much greater than 1, this will guarantee that the gravitational coupling is small. Now, in our favorite examples of ADS-CFT, n is typically like the rank of a gauge group. But from this point of view, you can think about it more generally. Okay, that's the large n limit. I don't think I shocked anybody by saying this. The other one, the next one, is the existence of the classical limit. And basically what you want to demand is that the limit, as n goes to infinity, that makes sense. So how do you do that? Well, one, there's a couple of different things that you need to demand, but the most obvious one is that what you would really like to have is, instead of having just one CFT with a fixed value of n, you'd like to have a family of CFTs, C, labeled by the value of n. So you'd like to be able to tune the coupling constant. And so you have a family of theories like that, and in each such theory, you can count the number of local operators at scaling dimension delta, and this is labeled by n. And then what you want to demand is that the limit as n goes to infinity of rho n of delta exists. Okay, so as you take the classical limit for any fixed delta. So you fix the scaling dimension, and then you look at your family of CFTs, and what you want is that the spectrum converges. Okay, and if this is the statement that there's a finite number of fields in the bulk, what you would not like to have is have, you know, some matter sector that, you know, like some gauge fields in the bulk whose the rank of that bulk gauge group would depend on 1 over L Planck or something like that. Or that you have a number of scalars that grows as you take the Planck length to 0.
Why do we want number 2? I mean, why isn't it enough to just have a very large n? Like, for example, these string compactifications to ADS that exist for discrete.
Why do you want to be able to tune?
Yeah, I mean, this might make some mathematical convenience, but I it's not clear why you need this.
Well, that's a question. You're listing things that will make it the job easier, but they're not necessary.
This I would argue is necessary.
It's necessary to call it gravity, right?
Yeah, I mean, I want a theory. I don't want any theory of, like I said, saying at the beginning, you know, in some sense, any CFT gives you a theory of quantum gravity, but I don't want any theory. I want one that behaves like GR at low energies. I think if you don't impose this, your correlators will look very weird in the classical limit.
I'm not complaining about having a finite number of fields.
Yeah.
I think there's probably a way to say this where you don't have to take the sequence of queries. Where you say, well, we don't, below the Planck scale, there's a number of fields. I mean, it's that's a problem.
Yeah, so I think what you're asking is about isolated points that may have, there may be quantum theories of gravity that are semi-classical, but they just come at a fixed value of n. Is that?
Yeah.
That,
like,
yes.
String landscape.
So, okay, you're pushing me into, yes. So indeed, there could be isolated points like this, and I think those would be very interesting. I don't know of any. There's certainly theories of gravity where there's no coupling that you can tune, and those exist. But in all the things we've seemed to have found, there's always some sort of...
It's the lamppost.
But it could be the lamppost, yeah. So, yeah.
And in the real world, the plant scale is finite. So,
it,
so
yes.
It's fine. Wow.
Yes. But LADS is, well. Yes, but of course. So, yeah, I agree that this may not be fully necessary, and you may want to relax this. For what I'll say today, I'll consider theories. I'll imagine having, you know, families of theories labeled by N, but I agree, in principle, you can consider isolated points. Good. And so, okay, this is what I would like. So you've already sort of pushed me on whether how necessary this is. This is what I would call sort of step zero, and you really need to sort of start here. And then where you go from here depends a little bit on your taste. So the typical strategy that's been employed is, you know, pick some observable you like in the CFT and demand that it matches what you would get from a GR computation and infer from that a set of conditions on the CFT. And there's basically two types of observables that have been considered. The first one is partition functions. Actually, I'm writing them sort of more in a anti-chronologic order, but and the other one is local correlation functions. Good. And so let me say a few words about both. So local correlation functions. So this sort of all started, I guess this is a local product, this all started here by the work of Hemskirk, Panedonis, Polchinski, and Sully, I guess roughly 10 years ago. And so what they showed, they had sort of two main points in their paper. The first one, maybe let me call it A to not mix with the conditions, is they showed that there's a dictionary between EFTs and ADS, and CFT data in the 1 over N expansion. And this actually, they demanded one more condition that I'll call number 3, which is large N factorization. Now, before you push me on it, I will also dispute large N factorization in a second. But let me just first explain what it is for the people that are not familiar. The idea is to divide the set of local operators of your theory into two classes. There are single trace operators. Can you guys see if I write here or barely? Okay, I won't go lower. So they're single trace operators whose connected correlation functions go like n to the minus, I guess, 2 minus, 2 plus n minus 2. So connected correlators of single trace operators will be suppressed at large number of operators. And you also have double trace or multi-trace operators, which we typically call O to the K, normal order. And those can have connected correlation functions, which are order 1. Okay, so that's how we distinguish the two class of operators. And so what that means from the point of view of what I was saying here is that all couplings of the theory are Plankian suppressed. And again, this is perhaps a lamppost effect because we're considering gauge theories. What we would ideally like to do is relax this. Because we would like to, for example, put the standard model in ADS. The standard model might have some internal strongly coupled dynamics, and it's only the coupling to gravity which is weak. But what large N factorization does, and this is what we've been using for many years in ADS CFT, is consider that all couplings are Plankian suppressed. Okay, so again, if you, at least now I pushed myself, so this is a restriction that we would actually really like to be able to relax. Good, so what did HPPS show? They showed that there's a dictionary between CFT data and the large N limit and any effective field theory that you would write down in ADS. And by CFT data, I mean the various scaling dimensions of these operators here and their OPE coefficients. So, you know, they did it for scalar fields. So say you write some effective Lagrangian like this. Well, they gave you a map of how to map that to CFT data. So this one is very easy. For scalar operators, it's completely fixed by symmetry. And this is just the OPE coefficient of the single trace operator O. And then what they showed is that if you turn on quartic interactions for the scalar fields, well, this will change the, it will give anomalous dimensions to the multi-trace operators and change the OPE coefficients. And what they showed is, you know, you pick your favorite EFT, and then they'll give you a set of CFT data that's crossing invariant. So that satisfies the bootstrap constraints. And from this picture, since there's sort of a dictionary, a one-to-one map, it sort of looks like anything goes. Okay, and that's why many bootstrappers, what you'll hear them say sometimes, or you heard them say a lot, and now not so much anymore, is that the bootstrap is weak at large n. So, you know, if you try to do the bootstrap for the Ising model, you really get islands and places where you can't go. But what sort of came, the philosophy that came out of this was that somehow at large n, all these bounds become weak and you do whatever you want. Okay, so anything goes, and the point is that, and so this, I guess, Sandipan will tell you all about this is, well, not quite. And in the end, so there's really exciting progress happening now is that we're seeing that especially if these operators are not scalars, but if they have spin, due to causality and properties in the Regi limit, actually there's other constraints that what you could have just naively seen from here. Okay, so back then there was a sort of philosophy of anything goes, and now we're learning that it's not quite, and making that precise, I guess you'll tell us all about this in a few minutes. Good. And then they had a second point in their paper, which now is referred to as the HPPS conjecture, or the large gap conjecture, which is that if you demand one more condition, large gap, if you demand that the conformal dimension of any single trace operator whose spin is greater than 2, that this is bigger or equal to something that I'll call delta gap, which is much greater than 1, then essentially the bulk is GR. Or GR plus a finite number of matter fields. And that this is a sufficient condition. Okay, and I guess, and part of the exciting progress has been understanding exactly what the implications for large gap are and how you can prove how do you actually prove that they give you gravity, that this assumption gives you gravity. Good. Sorry?
This only goes one way.
I would say both.
You're narrow, but I...
Yeah. Okay.
So what would you say?
Yeah, so SYK, so I'm going to deflect any questions about ADS2 CFT1, or it's a bit... I think that works sort of very differently than any higher dimensional version of it. In SYK, there's an infinite delta gap is order 1, but somehow many the gravity theory still behaves like gravity. And we sort of saw that in Gabor's talk yesterday. There's a sort of extra suppression of the stringy degrees of freedom. But yeah.
So this would say that string theory in small ADS is not gravity.
String theory.
So this gap only exists for a strong coupling.
For a strong coupling.
In the case of N equals 4.
Yeah.
You would say if it goes both ways, that only For a week.
For a week, the couple.
Coupling is equals 4 joules of gravity.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I would say, I mean.
It's fingering of gravity.
No, it's gravity, but it's not.
It's not GR. It's very stringy gravity.
Yeah. Yeah. There's large corrections.
Yeah.
So people mean various things. For example, when they use the word holographic CFT, they mean various things. One is the fact that there exists a bulk dual picture, and that includes weakly coupled ones. It's just the bulk picture is string theory. What I've been trying to push on here is that we're really looking for theories that whose IR description is well approximated by GR. And if you take weakly coupled n equals to 4, there'll be large corrections. But it's still it's string theory, so it's still gravity in some different sense. It's just that it has large corrections to GR. In most situations, there's very simple correlators that you could compute in that theory where you would tell. But I think if you just first of all, you're going to have, you know, massive higher spin particles around. And then you compute a correlator of those, and they'll involve, I mean, if you try to truncate the correlator to just the contribution of the stress tensor and a few other operators, you're going to get very off from what the actual answer is. But, okay. Yeah. I mean,
some would argue that those fields need to be there for the theory to make sense at all.
There's an effective field theory with a cutoff that's well below ADS scale, where you can just use Einstein gravity
exactly.
For small corrections, and string theory is not that. It's a string scale on the ADS scale.
Yeah. That's what you want. That's what you're looking for.
Definition.
Yeah. That's what I meant by this, is that, you know, there's a regime of the theory where you can just approximate the contributions by the GR, and you get very close to the actual answer. Okay. Good. So that was a large gap. So that's sort of what I wanted to say about correlation functions. Okay, perfect. And so the other sort of axis that's been pursued is to instead look at partition functions. So partition functions, instead of local correlators, they probe slightly different things. They probe, instead of, you know, knowing about, for example, the contribution of a particular spin 3 operator, they'll know more about the average spectrum, the way the spectrum grows, the total number of operators. That's sort of the relevant thing. And here the sort of starting paper was a paper by Hartmann, Keller, and Stoica in 2013. Oh, and I should say that this is not only restricted to two-dimensional CFTs, but works best in two dimensions. So what they did is the following. They said, okay, let me demand that my finite temperature partition function in the CFT matches what you get from GR, which is the following. You get the thermal ADS contribution at low temperatures, and the contribution of the BTZ black hole at high temperatures. And ask, what do I need to impose on my CFT such that in the large C limit, this is what the partition function looks like. And what they found is that, well, that will be satisfied if the density of low-lying operators grows smaller or equal to this exponential growth with coefficient 2 pi for all conformal dimensions below C over 12. And this is the condition that people refer to as the sparse spectrum.
In the spirit of arguing with everything that you write down,
yes,
this is an incredibly strong constraint, and there are perfectly good local theories of gravity that you can imagine violating this. This is saying that there's no other phases besides just BTZ and MTADS.
What theories do you know that violate this?
I don't know of any theories, but you can imagine things with multiple black holes or all sorts of other, some other phase, and it would be a perfectly good theory of gravity. You very well know at higher genus, the analogous thing is not true for perfectly ordinary weakly coupled theories.
Yes.
So this is a very strong constraint. stronger than any others.
It's not very strong. I mean, it's just that it's less than Hagedorn.
Well, that's the result. I mean, the original. The input.
I think he's disputing the fact that you want to. I mean, so people have tried to push on this pretty hard in the context of, you know, microscopic black hole counting and that kind of stuff. And there are multi-centered solutions. There's enigmas. There's a ton of very interesting stuff, and they can dominate in the microcanonical sum. They never do in the canonical sum. Again, is this a lamppost thing? Maybe. Yeah.
Sorry, I'm confused. You say they never dominate in the canonical ensemble? I thought there were cases, I'm a little confused about the references, but I thought there were cases where at least, I don't know, canonical ensembles with charge or with R charge or something, where there was some localization on the S3, for example, on a T4 cross S3 cross ADS3 compactification or something of that kind.
Where the enigma, those would be cases where the enigmas dominate or multi-centered?
I've forgotten all the details. I think I could locate a reference if I push
okay.
myself.
So, I mean, it's possible that with flavored partition functions, you can change what happens here a lot. So if you add chemical potentials, also, by the way, if you play with spin structures for fermions, you can drastically change what happens here. So, as far as I know, for just the usual trace e to the minus beta h, just the usual partition function, there are no solutions who dominate the canonical ensemble. But there are known solutions that dominate the microcanonical ensemble.
No, but there's this thing called wall crossing, no? Where you can have this thing, the partition function dominated by a single-centered black hole, and then you cross on wall.
It decays into, yes, but this is sort of, the point is that this does not affect this picture. What you're saying is something that happens.
But isn't that for the index? Which is computed in the canonical ensemble?
Yeah, but it has, well, first of all, the index has, it has various things. It has a U1, it has a chemical potential, like the elliptic genus has a chemical potential for the U1 charge, so this is maybe more along what Don was saying, and also it has -1 to the F, right? So, I mean, it's, I'm making a statement for this object. I don't know what the full set of generalizations are that you might want to include. But okay, thank you. Please, I will only maybe write one more condition, and please also fight it as hard as you can. That's what we're here to do. Okay, but now the thing that I want to do now is underline something that is very important. I think it's somehow a misconception sometimes in the field is that people use the words large gap and sparse spectrum interchangeably, and they're really not at all the same thing. And the easiest way to say that, to see that, is that there are many theories that we know that saturate this bound. So this bound is a Hagedorn growth, right? So it allows for theories that have a string scale equal to the ADS scale. And such a theory would have an infinite tower of higher spin operators, a very small dimension. And so this allows for theories of small gap. And at the same time, you could have a theory with a large gap, but so many scalar operators that you violate this. I don't know if a theory like that is consistent or not. I don't have an example of one, but it hasn't been proven that it's not. So these are really two different pieces of the story. And yeah, they should not be mixed with one another. They're just really two different pieces. And you know, probably both of them are necessary, although you've thought both, I think, by now. But within some corner of theory space, they're both necessary, but they're not sufficient, and they're not equal to one another.
And the dimensions larger than 2, you know how to formulate 4, but I'm not sure that you know how to formulate 5.
Yeah, so there's been a bit of progress on this. So one thing that you can, so the problem is that in higher dimensions, this highly relies on modular invariance. And so in higher dimensions, you have to ask a little bit, what type of partition function are you going to consider? So one thing that we did is to look at higher dimensional tori, on which there is a modular invariance. And from that, you can derive a set of constraints. It looks a bit similar to this. There's additional conditions on the Casimir energy on the torus. You can try to play those games. But the problem is that the spectrum on the torus in higher dimensions is not counting local operators. This is counting local operators. So you can write stuff down, but it's a bit tricky. You can also look at the sphere partition function, and that's counting local operators, but then you don't have modular invariance. So you don't know. You can put by hand what the Hawking page temperature you get from GR, and this is something that Edgar has done. And then you'll get something, but it's put in by hand a little bit. So I think it would be really interesting to push on this more in higher dimensions, but yeah, we seem to be blocked.
I always think that the result of this is more a convincing condition than the input. I mean, that's no problem in higher dimensions. Like demanding that there's a sub-Hagedorn, even demanding that the Hagedorn temperature is, if it exists,
parametrically large,
is I think a very reasonable condition.
I'm very glad that you brought that up because that is the last condition I'll write down before giving it the floor over to Sandipan. So. There's another the condition that I think is that I actually am hoping somehow is sufficient, and actually equal to large gap. So by the way, I believe that large gap is sufficient. It's just nobody's proven it, and many people believe that it's sufficient, but nobody's formally proved it. And we've tried to find a name for this, and we failed. Nothing sticks somehow. But so I'm gonna write a very sparse spectrum.
What do you mean? If you say that the condition is sufficient, but you also claim that all the other ones are necessary, what do you mean by?
Oh yeah, sorry. I mean, I'm going to assume all the other ones are true. Large N factorization, large N convergence of the spectrum, and then I think once you're there, if this is satisfied, what I believe, but okay, and most of the bootstrappers I think believe, is that this is now. If you add this on top, then that's sufficient. And I guess you'll tell us a little bit about at least aspects of that proof. By assuming this, you can start deriving pretty cool stuff. We haven't proven it fully, but hopefully we're getting closer. Good. So the very sparse spectrum is what Henry was referring to, is that if you can show that the spectrum is bounded by a growth, which is strictly sub-Hagedorn, I mean, I shouldn't box this. This is more like conjectural. So that might be sufficient. And the philosophy behind this is to take alpha to be some fraction, which is d minus 1 over d. And then what this means is that if you want the partition function of your bulk fields goes like this is the free energy of the bulk fields. Goes like t to the d. And that's what would happen in a local quantum field theory.
Do you want that condition, or do you just want the coefficient of delta to be small?
Well, if you can make the coefficient of the Hagedorn growth parametrically small, then I can restrict myself to be in a range of regimes where it's not Hagedorn, and then I want it to look like this. I mean, if you can find a theory, the problem is that so I could write down something like this, right? Times, 10 to the minus 20 delta or something like that, right? I can write this down, but this can't be valid for small values of delta, right? So you have to say how the spectrum grows before you reach the string scale. So what I would want is that below the string scale, it behaves this way.
Don't you want a condition that allows string theory? Small alpha prime?
Yeah, but small alpha prime tells you that there's a range of conformal dimensions where I don't need to worry about the Hagedorn growth.
Okay, what, you want to put a range there somewhere?
Yeah, so I mean this should be, what you really want to say is that this should be valid in delta much bigger than 1, much smaller than delta gap or something like that. For some delta gap, delta gap. Much smaller than some delta gap, with some delta gap that you can make as big as you want. You want to have a parametric regime where string states don't contribute. Good. And then, if you believe that all theories of quantum gravity are related to string theory, you might want to say something like d has to be smaller or equal than 11. But I'm not boxing this one. Believe it too. I mean, I'm being recorded. I should be very careful what I say, but yeah. This is something that I believe in. You're free to challenge that as well. Nobody challenged this. It's anyway. So
I can do that.
Okay, yes. Thank you.
Is there a factor of n in delta gap? Because you can have a large energy, total energy, but the energy density or temperature could be smaller than the strain scale. So. I'm nitpicking, but
No, so delta gap should be a number that does not scale with n in the simple.
Right, but I think normally you would demand this the intensive energy scale that determines whether this is valid or not, the temperature, let's say. So you expect this behavior for, let's say, temperatures.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. So this is a very good point. So this is what happens sort of below Hawking Page, right? This is about the growth of low-lying states, and then at some point, you know, you have to transition to something like this, where now this is not the same d. This is the d of the CFT, and this has a coefficient which is n to some power. Is that what you're asking? This is the extensivity of the CFT.
Maybe it's not important then.
Okay. So this is all about sort of, you know, the effective field theory side of this. This has nothing to do with black holes.
If you have a big box of gravitons, right?
Yeah.
At some low temperature, you might have a lot of energy because the box is very big. And so the string corrections are not important. It might be more than the string scale of energy. Like, we have, I don't know, in a glass of water, we have more energy than the Planck mass, but it's not. The density of states is still given by this formula.
Yeah, I'm not sure. What I would want to say is that we're always thinking of a situation where we're on a sphere of which we fix the size in the CFT. So all energies are measured compared to the size of that sphere. So I think that sort of fixes the size of the box. You can think about that roughly in that sense. And then we're always talking relative to that. I don't know if you're happy with that answer. Okay, I don't think I have nothing else maybe to say, then maybe we can discuss it after. Okay, so that's sort of the, well, at least my picture of sort of where we stand with all of this. And so, yeah, I think I'll pass it on to you. I don't know how it did with time, but yeah. Thanks.
To give you all this.
Oh, you have to take your phone out of your pocket in case you create interference.
Okay. So, in this part, the title is different. So it's bootstrapped
and holography.
So basically what I'll do is the following. So I'll discuss how bootstrap can help understanding this HDPS conjecture when gravity is dynamical. So basically, I'll provide a partial proof of this conjecture for the three-point function of CFT correlators. And then, if I have time, I'll talk about high spin particles in ADS. So everything I discussed today, that's for CFT dimension greater than or equal to 3. And most of it is based on papers with some set of combination of these authors. So before I begin, let me specify what I mean by HDPS conjecture. I'll not need these six conditions. All I need is some large N condition. And to be specific, by large N, I mean the stress tensor two-point function. So obviously this is fixed by conformal inference. I have some tensor structure. And there is a central charge, Ct. So when I say large n, I basically mean this Ct is large. So that's the first condition I need. And the second condition is, let me call this 2, the large gap condition, which is basically the spectrum of higher spin single trace primary operators. By higher spin, I mean spin greater than 2. So the lightest operator is above some gap, which is delta gap, which is large. And because I'm talking about single trace, obviously I'm assuming some kind of large n factorization. So the question is then, so the HPPS claim is that these setup safeties, they have a gravity-like behavior. So let me make that more precise. So if I have some safety data, it's not that any safety data that you give me that will be consistent with these two conditions. So that means these two conditions, they should impose some restriction on what kind of safety data that can give me a holographic description. To begin with, let's consider only scalar operators. So the two-point function of scalar in any CFT obviously is fixed by conformal invariance. But if you then consider three-point function of F or phi with, let's say, stress tensor, so the tensor structure, again, is completely fixed by conformal inference. And there is some number over here. Even this number is fixed by the C naught from water entity. So in short, this is completely fixed by the two-point function.
Sir.
Yeah.
Isn't that number, I mean, it's more fixed by delta than by C naught, no? Isn't it the weight?
Yeah, it's a combination of C naught and delta. Ah, yeah. Okay. But obviously, this is true in any safety in any dimension. But obviously, this is not true if this operator phi has spin. But if I demand that a safety has a gravity dual, actually this statement has to be true approximately for spinning operators as well. So this three-point function should be fixed by the two-point function with some correction which are surface by the gap. This follows from causality in the bulk side. So this is basically the statement that in the gravity side, two derivative action is the dominant one, and if you add extra derivative, that should come with some extra cutoff, which is basically the correction terms. For example, let's consider the three-point function of stress tensors. And this statement, actually, this is true even when O is the stress tensor operator. So in general, in any CFT, this stress tensor three-point function, it's completely fixed up to three numbers. So these are tensor structures that are fixed. So they come with some number, which are called peak coefficients. So obviously, in general, this is not true. So whatever I say is true in dimension greater than 4. But let me stick to CFT 4. So there, these coefficients, they have some physical meaning. So there, this A, B, this A and C, they are the coefficients that you have in the stress anomaly. So this same A appears here with some known tensor structure. This C appears here with some known tensor structure. This B doesn't actually, I don't know of any physical meaning for this coefficient B, but because it's sitting between A and C, I have to call it B. I don't have any option. Okay. Now, from the ADS side, now if I look at the Graviton three-point function, bulk causality tells us that this should be the leading order given by the Einstein gravity term, plus obviously there will be corrections which are suppressed by some cutoff scale. So that means these three coefficients A, B, C, they cannot be independent for theories with a gravity description. In particular, if I translate this into a CFT statement, it goes the following way. So A minus C, it should be 0 plus corrections, which are suppressed by delta gap square. And B is 0. Again, corrections are suppressed by delta gap square. So then the question is, why this set of CFTs with large N and large gap, why should they have this kind of behavior? Before I address that, any question? The way to address this question in CFT
let's consider a d-dimensional safety, and let's restrict only to a 2D subspace. So this is some spatial direction y. This is time. And these are the null directions. Let's consider this particular configuration. I have some scalar operator psi somewhere here at UV, and another operator psi, which is exactly a Rindler reflection of this operator at minus U minus V. Then I have a stress tensor inserted here, and again it's Rindler reflection. So when I use this symbol, what I mean is the following. What I mean by this symbol is Rindler reflection, where I get minus V star minus Y star. And where P is the number of T and Y indices here. Notice one thing. These two operators, they are time-like separated, and these two operators, they are also time-like separated, which is going to be important for us.
Matt, can I ask
yes.
you a very basic question? Mm-hmm. I think I got lost at this point where you say, where you start studying the three-point function of gravitons.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you have to pick a gauge for that? Is there no gauge choice implicit in that? And then, yeah.
So whatever gauge you choose here, that should be the same gauge. Like, this is...
Right, but then you want to match to CFT, so how does that go? Is there a simple way to...
So generally, like, you can let's say, choose the permanent ground gauge. Like, whatever gauge you choose, this statement is gauge independent. The thing that will change how you relate your graviton to a boundary stress tensor,
right.
But this statement...
I see. You then use some dictionary.
Yeah.
That space, you would be talking about the three-point amplitude, the scattering amplitude.
Okay, so now the important thing is I'll consider this particular Lorentzian correlator. So because some operators are time-like separated, the ordering is important. First of all, this is not time ordered, and this is normalized by the two-point function. So there is another correlator that I can write down. Actually, there are many different orderings that I can write down, but let me also write down the following correlator. Which is, of course, related to the first one by some analytic continuation.
That's a T bar in the numerator?
Say that again.
Is that a T bar?
Yeah, by bar I mean
Do you want to put a bar?
You want to put a bar on top? You missed a bar.
No. Oh, yeah, yeah, that's right. Oh, yeah. Yes, yeah, thanks. So these two correlators, they are related to each other by some analytic continuation. And the second one is what called a Rindler reflection symmetric configuration. So this is this kind of correlators, they are actually positive. This kind of correlator with this particular ordering, they have to be positive. Another important point is, if you just use the standard IFSM description, you can show that to get this correlator from the Euclidean correlator, you actually don't have to cross any branch curve. This is determined completely by the Euclidean correlator. But to get the first one, you actually have to cross some branch curve. So this is a non-trivial correlator, non-trivial Lorentzian correlator. I have to introduce some other notations, which can be annoying. Okay. The yes.
Positive and real.
Yeah, positive and real. Yeah. This one doesn't have to be real. Yes. Okay. So now, the CFT argument actually relies on the Regi limit of the CFT correlator, so I have to introduce that. So this U and V that I wrote down here, they, let me spell my trace them this way, where eta is less than 0, less than 1. But sigma can be anything. So the Regi limit is defined for the first correlator in the following way. You take, you keep eta fixed, and then take sigma to 0. So this is the Regi limit. Oh, actually, let me be more careful. Okay, so this is, yeah, in general, this is the Regi limit, but probably I should be more careful. This is much, much less than 1, but this is larger compared to 1 over central charge. So now this correlator G and G star, they have some nice property in terms of this new variables. First property is G as a function of complex sigma. It's analytic in the lower half sigma plane. A near sigma zero. So this can be checked. This follows from the analytic structure of Euclidean correlators. If you just assume that Euclidean correlators are single-valued and analytic as long as points are non-coincident, this follows from that. And this is related to causality. So this, you can think of this as some statement about causality. The second property that G follows is the following. Real part of G is bounded by G naught when sigma is real. So
So this again follows from the fact that this correlator is positive. From there, you can actually show that if you cross the branch cut to get to the first correlator, it can only decrease. And roughly, you can think of this as a statement about linearity. Any question? Okay, so now the rest of the argument is straightforward. In the complex sigma plane, I take this particular contour, so some line from minus R to R, which is connected by a semicircle. Oh, another point that I should mention. So this G0 can be computed using the Euclidean OPE. And because you don't have to cross in branch cut, in the Regi limit, this is approximately equals to 1. Everything else, all the other terms are suppressed by some positive power of sigma. So you can just ignore these terms. So only thing I have is 1. Now, because 1 minus this quantity, 1 minus g, this is analytic in this region. What I can do I can write down the integral on this semicircle. Yes. As the real part of the line integral. So now if I take this R, satisfy the condition that it's small but large compared to one of our city, then I can actually compute this correlator G on this semicircle. Yes?
Can you say why you're taking R and S sigma bigger than 1 over CT? Like, what goes wrong when you're...
Oh, it's a computational thing. So in this regime, I can actually compute the correlator. So that's why.
But what happens when you reach R's of order 1 over CT?
So the computational breakdown, like the
factorization breaks down, or...?
Factorization will not, but... So... under the condition of large n and large gap, only reason this method has any power is basically because I can actually compute the correlator in this particular regime. So nothing will break down, but they will not be able to relate some number or some CFT data with something else. So if you just give me the CFT data and the condition of large n and large gap, I have some computational power in this regime. So basically, I can compute the correlator here. So basically, that means this part of the equation, I can relate them to CFT data. On the other hand, this part of the correlator, basically the correlator on the real axis, I don't have any computational power, but I have the second condition, which tells me this has to be positive. So that means whatever I get from the left-hand side, whatever expression in terms of CFT data, that should be positive here. And the way you can actually you can compute this correlator on the semicircle, you can use conformal Regi theory, or you can use some other tricks that I'll discuss in 5 minutes. So this has the following behavior. So basically, obviously there will be other correction terms. So the leading correction goes as 1 over sigma, suppressed by 1 over central charge, with some function, which is a function of of the polarization of the stress tensor and this eta. And if you plug that in here, it will basically tell you this function, for any choice of the polarization, it has to be positive. And now, let me show you how to actually simplify this further. If I want to compute this coordinate at G for large N, large gap theory, obviously the leading contribution will come from identity exchange. So when I write a diagram like this, I mean corresponding confirmed block. So then I have the stress tensor if there are other single stress operators in the theory with spin less than 2, they'll contribute as well. And all the double stresses will contribute. So in general, this is a mess. But we can make some approximations. For example, first we can make this scalar to be very heavy so that I can ignore all the double test contributions. Also, when I take the radial limit, all these other single test operators, they will be sub-subleading. So I can ignore them as well. So basically, I left with T and double stress of stress tensor. I can stop here. I can actually use conformal Reggie theory to actually compute this entire thing. But we can actually use one more trick. So whatever I said in the beginning about the four-point function, it does not require this operators to be localized at a point. So I can use actually some smearing function to actually smear them over some region. As long as I do that in a symmetric way, whatever I said before, everything goes through. If you choose this smearing cleverly, and then there's actually a very nice choice of the smearing, that actually can get rid of this entire tower. So basically, I have 1 and the stress tensor.
Do you have some intuition why that happens?
From gravity, yes. It's basically, let me draw it somewhere here. So this four-point function in terms of Witten diagrams, so it's something like this. So when you make this psi heavy, what it does is basically, so in the beginning, these two integrals are over the entire radius. So if you make this psi heavy, what it does, it basically collapses the integral to the on the GRSA. So that smearing is designed such that it does the same for this as well. So now, if you take any Witten diagram and if you make that, if you convert these integrals into integrals on geodesics, so that's basically a geodesic Witten diagram, which is basically the stress tension in such block. So that's a known fact. So the trick is basically to find some smearing which collapses this integral on a geodesic.
So you get a single block.
Yeah, yes. So basically, then this F over here, that's basically this contribution. That's why it has this TTT three-point function. If I skip some technical details, what I get in the at the end is something like this. So you, for example, you'll get something like this. You'll get some A minus C in this F with some polarization, some particular polarization, let's say N1, which is positive. But then you can actually choose a different polarization, which will give you a condition like this. So okay, so for some choice of N1, if you get this, you choose. You take some other polarization, you'll get the opposite condition, something like that.
Can I ask why this contribution will be imaginary?
Which one? This one?
Yeah, the second of the tree diagram.
So the way you have to compute it, so first you compute this correlator, but this, the way it's written, this is not exactly the correlator that I started with. So that's basically for that correlator, you have to actually cross a branch curve to get it. So the stress tensor, if you look at the stress tensor block in the Z plane, so it has some branch cut from one. So what you have to do, you have to cross the branch cut, then you have to approach zero. So when you do that, when you cross this branch cut, that's when you pick up this imaginary part. And actually, you can show that that's the dominant contribution in the Regi limit. OK, so basically, you can, from here, you can conclude that A and C, they should be the same. And similarly, you can show that B has to be zero. And you can, again, make the same argument for any other operator you like. You can choose any other operator with no spin. You can run the same argument. And you can actually show that any three-point function of the form, they are basically fixed by the two-point function of the same operator. It's basically the fact that both of them are coming from the two derivative part of the action. Any question?
Sorry.
Yes.
From this point of view, how do you determine the fact that the correction was 1 over delta gap squared?
You can. I can explain it to you later because it's more technical. But you can actually, yeah, okay, that's a good point. So actually, not just that, you can actually estimate the correction from delta gap, and you can actually show that this should go as delta gap square for both B and C. It's basically, okay, it's a, to explain that, actually I have to go to some details.
Okay. So
Sorry, I had a related question. So this correction, do you have an expression like in terms of the spectrum of the theory?
No, it's just basically I can just estimate that it should go as 1 over delta gap square. It's basically the estimate kind of comes from the fact, so this setup is basically is designed in design such that in ADS it's basically look like the psi is going like this and a graviton is going like this with there is a separation in the transverse direction. So that transverse direction is related to that eta that I had. So it's basically the limit eta goes to 1. The correction, the estimation of how it goes with 1 over delta gap, it's basically like how close to 1 I can get to without actually violating any of the conditions. That basically gives me 1 over delta gap square, but it doesn't give me anything, tells me anything else.
Just so I think I'm trying to catch up on the logic. So first, you compute these two diagrams.
Mm-hmm.
You use the fact that the real part of G has to be less than G star.
Mm-hmm.
To say that this F has to be positive.
Yes.
And then you compute this F, mm-hmm. and you see that for one polarization you get A minus C is greater than 0, and mm-hmm. for another you get A minus C is less than 0.
Yeah, that's right.
So you conclude from this that A minus C has to equal 0 always?
For the computation, obviously, I'm starting with the assumption that I have large gain and large gap.
Yeah.
If you assume that, yes, always. So this is the only safety data which is consistent with closed conditions. So this method, even though it looks very general, obviously we all believe that the same kind of statement should be true even for higher point function. For example, if I have any number of t, we expect that under the condition of large n and large gap, this should be given by Einstein gravity plus small corrections. But to go beyond three-point function using this method it appears to be really tricky. And I actually don't know any easy way to do it. It's tricky both computationally and conceptually.
So you shown now, so this means that you've shown that large n and large gap imply Einstein gravity, basically.
Yes. Yeah. At least at the level of three-point function.
Sorry.
At the level of three-point function. Because this might be true for three-point function, but this might break down for, let's say, four-point or five-point function. From this method, there is no way to say that all t correlators will behave in the right way.
I see. So you're saying that if you have higher point t correlators, you might have it just might be inconsistent to have large n and large gap. I see. So you might be able to derive this condition
mm-hmm.
and higher points. You just get a condition that can't be satisfied or something.
Or I can get something which does not follow from Einstein gravity.
So related to that, you mentioned at the beginning that you can consider other spin operators, mm-hmm. not just three T's.
Mm-hmm.
So if you do that, is it clear that they would follow the same story, or could they be different?
No, if you consider any operator with spin zeros, obvious spin zeros, trivial one or two, everything is the same.
How about higher?
Spin? That's the next,
okay.
I'll talk about that in the next slide.
Okay.
Yeah.
The thing that I would imagine that would be natural to do would be to compute the four-point function of these spin operators
mm-hmm.
with a T exchange, and then try to match with the gravitational potential.
You mean the four-point function of stress tensor or
no, spinning operators with, but then they exchange a T. That's like 2 to 2.
Yeah, that has been done. Yes.
And you get a similar condition.
Yeah. So basically, if you the final result is like any. This any such correlator where O can be scalar, spin 1, or spin 2, for the structure is completely fixed. That's what you get. And it's basically consistent with the two derivative action. And obviously, the story is different if you have higher spin. By higher, I mean spin greater than 2. So the, to get into that, let me just summarize the HKPA, the large gap condition in the following way. So if this is delta, and this is the spectrum of single trace primary operator with spin greater than 2. So the HKPA condition is basically there is nothing below some gap. And obviously, from string theory, we expect there should be a tower above that gap. Now, it's natural to ask, what happens if I deform this condition by adding just, let's say, one operator somewhere? Or any finite number of higher spring primary operator. So do I get a consistent CFT? And so I can run exactly the same argument where this is a primary operator with spin greater than 2. And follow the same logic. So to begin with, OK, before that, I should note a couple of things. First of all, if there is a higher, there is a single higher spin primary operator, first of all, we know that it cannot be conserved. So the dimension of the operator should be above the, strictly above the unitary bound. Because any finite number of conserved higher spin currents, they gives you inconsistencies. They violate causality and unitarity as well, I think. And the next thing is, if you have a single high spin current, non-conserved, and this three-point function, if O is any other operator in the theory, if this three-point function is non-zero, even in that case, you'll run into trouble. Because then you can show that this function f, this will grow faster than, it will grow with a power a which is greater than 1, which is inconsistent with the chaos bound. So even if you have higher spin operator, all these three-point functions, they must vanish. But this is not sufficient to actually rule them out. Because, for example, in a theory, you can give all these higher spin particles some, this higher spin operator some global symmetry such as Z2. Then this three-point function should vanish naturally. So the way you can actually rule this higher spin operators out completely, if you can show that this three-point function is zero. So this, if this operator exists, this three-point function is completely fixed by the two-point function of XJS. Or let me be more specific. So this three-point function, from conformal inference, you can show that this is completely fixed up to 3 J OP coefficients. So J is the spin of the operator. So then what identity tells you the following thing? Some linear combination of these OP coefficients, they should be order 1. Basically, this is related to the two-point function of XJS, which I take to be 1. So that means if this operator exists, at least one of these OP coefficients should be non-zero. Now, if I run this entire argument again, roughly what I get is the following. I get at the end some four-point function like this for any choice of the polarization here should be positive. So, and again, this is smeared in the appropriate way. And by choosing various different polarization, you can actually show that there is no consistent solution. So all of them should be zero. Basically, this is sufficient to say that if you add any finite number of higher spin single test operators, even when they satisfy this condition to be consistent with the chaos bound, even then they are not consistent with unitarity, causality, and crossing symmetry. So how much time do I have?
Is a flat space version of this argument, like a gravity version of this argument?
Yes, using Eichner scattering.
So naively, I would expect that you have some heavy spin particles and it would create a gravitational field as long as it's an S wave.
Yeah.
It would be fine.
So basically, the flat space version of this is basically, again, the Eichner scattering fire, you basically boost the high spin particle and you have some scalar or graviton which it's interacting with. Then you can always find polarization that fires it. Okay, you have to go to this particular regime.
Okay.
So you take S to be large first, then you take T to be large compared to the mass of the particle. There, you see, you cannot have positive phase shift.
I'm a bit confused. So, for example, Philip has recently written these papers that this type of coupling, I think, is related to the scattering of a graviton of black hole and stuff like that.
Yeah, you're talking about Nima's paper.
Yeah, so in that case, there is no problem.
So
I thought that there is one structure that is allowed and maybe other structures that are.
So, okay, for this, it has, like, whatever I'm saying, for that, it has to be elementary. And actually, I don't, like, so even for them, they have a very specific coupling that survived.
Mm-hmm.
So we had something similar to that, which actually did not survive. We actually did not match their result with our result. Like, what, I don't think these two couplings are the same kind of interaction. So I actually don't know the answer. I know which paper you're talking about.
Yeah. So my logic is they claim that Kerr gives you some particular couplings. So mm-hmm. You take a elementary particle with that coupling, and there shouldn't be no problem.
Yeah, so I did not check that particular interaction. But yeah, I know what you're talking about. I'm confused about that too, but I don't know. Because, like, at least the flat space argument that we make, so that should not, like, we can actually show that argument should not be valid for Kerr black holes. But for some reason, like, for their argument is basically valid for Kerr, and they get something which is which contradicts with our claim. So I'm not sure. Oh, I probably have minus 2 minutes.
Yeah, finishing up, I guess.
Yeah, okay, so then, okay, I'll probably Alex had more to say, but I ate up his time as well. Okay, then let me just stop here. Yeah, if you have any other questions.
Are there any further questions? Alex, you want to make a comment?
Yeah, maybe I should just make a comment about Juan's earlier question about rewriting it A minus T as a sum over the spectrum. So there's an alternate way to arrive at A equals to C from large gap, which is considering a commutator of two ANEC operators. They have to commute. And then that gets rid of all the multi-trace operators. So then you can literally write A minus T squared as the sum over all single trace operators of the theory. So you can write something down. The problem is that sum rule doesn't have only positive terms. So it's not a real sum rule in some sense. And then so you can't really give a precise bound. But you can at least rewrite it as the sum over all other single trace operators.
Is it A minus C or just T2? Sum?
A minus C.
In this last part, you ruled out having a finite number of heavy higher spin states, but what if you allow a continuum of them? Like you would have to do
that's allowed, yeah.
Like in the Kerr black hole, you would have to include all possible Kerr black holes with different spins.
That's right, but I don't remember if for their argument it was necessary. Yeah, I have to check. I'm not sure.
Okay, if there's no further questions, let's break and thank the speakers.